Since the foundation, right, of the modern circus as we know it in the 18th century. Yeah, it goes back. Circus has been presented in sort of defined spaces. It's always been about, like, you need to find a space that's suitable for what this is. So initially, like, performances were given in the open air, lots of big space. And slowly but surely over time, they kind of become a little bit more enclosed, eventually completely roofed. I know you're picturing the big top, probably, immediately when I say the word circus. There were even temporary wooden buildings and structures kind of, you know, put up. They eventually became quite, you know, semi-permanent, really, through the 19th century. And even, to an extent, some of them sort of became, and other buildings were put up, made of stone. Permanent buildings, permanent fixtures. Same way we know about our theatres. How do I know this? Well, I kind of sort of definitely did pinch that from the modern vaudeville press website, because they have just published a book by Steve Ward. It's called Opulence and Ostentation, Building the Circus. And I'm very, very happy that Steve is with me tonight to have a little chat about this. Steve, it's lovely to speak to you. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Rob, and thanks for inviting me on the show.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm a big fan. I'm going to just cut to the chase. I flipping love the circus, and you see what I did there. I'm a big fan of it. I love that performance side of it, and it's a show. It's a variety show, is a circus, and it's been around for a very, very long time. But I wondered if you remember sort of your earliest memories of the circus, those sort of very first introductions to it, perhaps in your life?
Oh, absolutely. If I go back to the dim and distant prehistoric past of my life, when I was 4 years old, I was taken to the circus by my mother and my grandmother as a birthday treat. And they had all arranged this, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me, but I had a ringside seat. And I can't remember much about the show. There were some horses, there were some people in the air on the trapeze. But about halfway through the show, into the ring came this solo figure in a loud, checked, baggy suit. It was Coco the Clown.
Yeah.
And he began his routine. And after a couple of minutes, he marched over to where I was sat, grabbed me under the armpits and plucked me from my seat. And I didn't know whether I was going to laugh or cry. And I'm sure I must have wet myself. I was only four at the time.
Yeah.
And he took me to the center of the ring, and he began his routine using me as his stooge. And he took me about 30 seconds to realize, hang on a minute, all the people out there, they're laughing at me. All the people out there, they're clapping me. Never mind this guy next to me. It's me.
Yeah.
They're applauding. And when he sort of gestured for me to take a bow, I took a bow and kept on taking a bow, much to his consternation. And eventually, in desperation, he picked me up under his arm and thrust me back in my seat. And Coco the Clown became my hero from that point. And I left the circus that day with the proverbial sawdust in my shoes.
Oh, that's possibly the best origin story I've heard in a very, very long time. But that's a love. It's beautiful, and actually, just if you don't mind, because I think I've said this a lot. Certainly, you know, 6 months ago, it's the 1st of June, you'll know where I'm going with this. There's a particular kind of theatre that frequents the stage, you know, up and down the land, and it's often an introduction to young people into the world of theatre and performance. Yeah, I'm talking pantomime, bear with me, I'm not going to go too near it. But those first interactions, those first exposures to these art forms are so impressive, I guess is the word, but I mean it in the sense the impression it makes upon you as a young person, as a child, it's a really big deal, and the fact that you remember it that vividly, I think, is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That you kind of remember. Yeah. It so what happened next for you in your little four-year-old Steve went home? What was the sort of thing that you wanted to do?
Coco the Clown became my hero, and I wanted to be a clown for many, many years. As I grew up, I liked entertaining, even though I sort of drifted into the sciences for a while.
Yeah.
And later on in life, I retrained in the theatre and got into slapstick and comedy and clowning and acrobatics and juggling. And I'd set my heart on being an acrobatic clown. And after I'd finished training, I began performing, and it wasn't long into my sort of early professional career that I had a nasty accident in a performance, and I had to stop doing acrobatics. So I then moved into teaching, and I started using circus in schools, both in terms of teaching circus skills and teaching about the culture and history of the circus, but also using circus as a way into other areas of the curriculum. But a good friend of mine, who was the director of the Hungarian State Circus, once said that the future of the circus lies with the children. And I believe that's absolutely fundamental. So I made it my mission to try and unite professional circuses and young people to educate young people in the rich cultural heritage of the circus. When I was in Germany when that first began in 1970s, and then when I came back to England, I set up my own youth circus in Leeds, where I live, and I had probably dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of children who and young people who came through the doors over the years that I ran it. And some of them went on to be professionals in their own right. Some of them became avid circus fans. Some of them came, tried, and went away again. That's fine. I had no problem with that. And then as I've got older and I can no longer climb a rope, I can't swing on a trapeze anymore, I sort of drifted into researching and writing and lecturing and, as my wife says, boring the pants off people about the circus.
Well, you're very welcome to bore me for the next 20 minutes or more there, Steve. I'm very happy with that at all. But I think, you know, one of the things I think there's a stereotype behind the circus, perhaps, you know, especially if you haven't been, you know, recently. And we're really lucky across Essex. We've got, you know, the occasional sort of, and I hope I'm not using the wrong phrases here, but like the occasional fair will come to town, and the occasional circus will kind of travel in as well. The likes of, I'm sure we've all heard of Zippo Circus as well. You know, these are sort of the businesses that, you know, we probably recognise and see from time to time. If you go in and out of Colchester much, you'll probably see it on the field on the left hand side. I think it's on, I want to say it's Cowdrey Avenue. It's not at Cowdrey Avenue, is it? Someone will know what I'm talking about, but you know the stretch I mean, that field on the left hand side. It is about getting young people interested in it, because as much as I am, you know, on paper, an adult, it's probably quite a lot harder to convince, you know, my generation or even like my parents' generation to get into the circus, because it's quite physical, you know. Even as an audience participant, you know, you do come away with quite a sore face half the time, laughing and smiling at the whole thing. What was the trickiest thing to learn when you did, you know, when you went through all that training you did? What was the activity that you found most tricky, but once you tried it, but on sort of beforehand you were unsure. You're like, well, I should be all right at this, but actually turned out to be a lot harder than you thought.
I mean, my bugbear is the unicycle. I just cannot ride a unicycle. I can walk on a globe, I can do a tightrope, walk on a tightrope. I have balance, but I cannot ride a unicycle, no matter how hard I've tried.
You don't know how much
So
better you've made me feel here, Steve, because I've been trying to learn it for a couple of years and it's so hard.
I
It's so, so hard.
what annoys me is my grandson, who's 9, said, I want a unicycle, Grandad. So I borrowed one for him. And the little so-and-so, after about a day, could actually ride it up and down the garden. And that really annoys me. But it was a lot of these activities. You have to go back in time to when they began. I mean, circus activities existed long before the foundation of the modern circus. There were itinerant performers. And once the sort of format of the circus had been grounded by Philip Astley in the 18th century, then you get this explosion of activities, and the activities became more daring. I mean, we watch the flying trapeze and we think how exciting and daring it is. But you have to remember, it was only in 1859 that the first flyer, Jules Leotard, actually began performing. And that was groundbreaking at the time. Now I have seen somebody do a quadruple spin in flying from hand to hand.
I mean,
It's amazing.
two's impressive, you know, like one we're impressed by, two's like, wow, that's incredible, how do you do it? The third one's like, well, that's not possible. There's almost no need to do four somersaults between. But it's pushing the boundaries, I think, you know, in an artistic sense, but also in a physical sense. I think
Oh,
circus,
yeah. I mean,
it's why we're so amazed by it as children or as adults. You watch it and you think, how can you possibly do that?
Yeah, it's the and that's part of the attraction of the circus. It is that pushing of the boundary, that danger element, that frisson of excitement when you go and you see these things happen. And I think that's the enduring appeal of the circus. And as you said earlier, you think of the circus and you think of the big top because that's what we see these days. And that was a comparatively later addition to the canon of circus history. It was an American invention in the mid 19th century. And you've got to remember that a lot of these activities in the early days took place in static buildings, whether they were of wood or whether they were later of stone and brick. And these ranged right across England, and right across Europe, from Scandinavia in the north, Trondheim in the north, right down through mainland Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, Imperial Russia, right down through the Iberian Peninsula. And of course, then circus was taken to the Americas and to Australasia, and you have sort of permanent circuses constructed there.
Is there
Some of
any
them still exist
I
today.
could say, is there anywhere in the world where circus isn't a thing?
It was interesting. I was talking the other day to somebody from Zimbabwe, and they were saying that in their culture, there is no circus heritage. And I think certainly in areas of Africa, there is no cultural concept of circus. It was only when the Europeans took the concept of circus to those countries that they became aware of circus. But if around if you I maintain if you stop anybody in the street anywhere in the world and you say, "What is a circus?" you will get an answer. You will rarely if ever get somebody who says, "I don't know." Right from the tiniest child up to the eldest person, what is a circus? You'll get an answer. And we have this sort of deep grain, it's part of our common cultural psyche. The circus is embedded within us. It is deeply rooted in our culture.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about this evening. I don't want to give away too much of the book because the book is now available for you to get. Opulence and Ostentation, Building the Circus, went on sale yesterday, officially into the world as of yesterday. So you can get your hands on a copy right now. And the man behind the whole book, Steve Ward, is with me to chat about it. Steve, where is the best place to point people right now to get a copy of this, looking at the history of the circus and where it is today?
Yeah, I mean, you can order a copy directly from the publisher, which is Modern Vaudeville Press. So I think you've got the website there. You can
I
pass
have,
that on to your
absolutely.
listeners. Internet book retailers, that famous internet book retailer.
Yep.
You can get, not allowed to say which one, but you
Well,
know which one I'm talking about.
you can, but it's fine. I always tell people go to your local bookshop and ask them to order it in for you. They support
Yeah,
local for sure.
but support your local bookshop and go to your local good bookshop and give them the title, and they should be able to track it down.
They'll get a copy for you. So, Opulence and Ostentation by Steve Ward, all you need to ask for on that front. But it's one of those things, I think, certainly my appreciation for learning history has grown dramatically over the last couple of years. And you don't have to be a fan of circus to enjoy a book about the history of it and where things have come from and kind of going back to it to the roots of stuff. I was only having a discussion earlier today about go-karting and how Formula One drivers and such start at go-karts and work their way up. And I said, well, the beauty of watching the greatest athletes or the greatest artists is sort of seeing and knowing where they come from and knowing the journeys and the stories. So it's always, I find really interesting to see how things are threaded through. And like you said, like I said at the start, the modern circus as we know it, as you said, everyone will have an idea of what they think the circus is. 18th century, we're talking 1700s. That's a
That's
long
right.
time for something to still be going. And I'm saying this with a question mark on the end history, but still going strong.
Oh, absolutely. Circus is as popular as ever. I think at the moment in the UK, there are something like 30 touring circuses. And you've got some static circuses, Blackpool Tower Circus, the Great Yarmouth Hippodrome. And in fact, they're the two surviving purpose-built circus venues. Blackpool Tower Circus was built in 1891 and is still going strong. And the Great Yarmouth Hippodrome was built in 1902. And they were conceived as purpose-built circus venues, and they're still used for circus. Some of the buildings you can still see, they're around, but they've been repurposed. For example, in Belfast, the Grand Opera House and Cirque, which was initially conceived as a circus theatre and gradually over time just became an opera house. It still has it's the only UK building that still has the appellation Cirque over the door.
Wow.
It's called the Grand Opera House and Cirque. The Brighton Hippodrome, which is undergoing renovation, certainly the turn of the century, turn of the 1900s, that was a purpose-built circus. Well, it was changed. It was initially an ice rink and then became a purpose-built circus. And
wow.
They're currently renovating the building, so they make it a multi-purpose arts venue. And like a lot of the circus buildings in the UK, they gradually, as the popularity of circus waned in the early part of the 20th century, and all bound up with World War One as well, and the repercussions, a lot of these buildings became repurposed as either theatres or cinemas, in fact, until eventually they became disused and many were eventually demolished. Sadly,
the supermarkets and flats. Was there any findings along the way? Like, you know, did Essex ever have like a purpose-built circus venue at all, or was there ever even a semi-permanent sort of structure in Essex?
There would have been many semi-permanent ones, and these were predominantly made of timber. And I think the intentionality of those buildings was that they would last a long time.
Yeah.
Unlike the Big Top, which arrives, sets up, stays for a week, takes down and moves on, these semi-permanent timber structures would last for a season, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, indeed, sometimes. And in fact, just moving away from Essex for a moment, in Leeds, where there were 12 different circus venues in the city centre during the 19th century, there was one particular place where there was a semi-permanent wooden structure that was in existence for about 60 years. You know, where do you draw the line between semi-permanent and permanent? There was always a circus structure there.
Yeah. And
you know, I just find it fascinating that these buildings, because labour was cheap and materials were plentiful, a circus company would arrive in Leeds, for example, or Colchester, and the circus owner would commission a circus building to be constructed for him. And when he'd finished, he would either auction it off and recoup his losses, or he would lease it to the next circus owner who came along, and so it would carry on.
So, and then until it was sort of paid for itself, it became like a business sort of in the sense of it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
When you were sort of researching this book, and I imagine it probably took a fair amount of time. It probably wasn't a couple of weeks of research here, but who was the audience you had in mind? Who was the reader that you hoped would, you know, sort of read through this book and discover more about the world of circus?
I mean, there are two strands, really. There are first, when I began researching it, I realised that lots of individual countries around the world had examples of permanent stone-built circuses, but nobody had done a comprehensive exploration of what buildings there were across the known world. So one target would be those people who clearly have an interest in circus, so they could find out more about it. But I try and balance my books, and I've written several on aspects of the history of the circus, I try and balance my books between those who want to follow the academic exploration of it and the general readership, so that you might pick up the book and you might say, oh, I never knew that before.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm hoping that the general reader will be able to read through it and think, I've heard of the Blackpool Tower Circus, and maybe I've heard of the Great Yarmouth, but I didn't know Brighton had a hippodrome. I didn't know Leeds had, you know, a couple of permanent circus buildings, or that, you know, there was one in Hull. Or the, you know, Charles Hengler built a series of them in Liverpool during the 19th century, and you know, up in Glasgow there were more,
amazing,
and so it becomes an interesting area. Or am I just a nerd? You know, just a circus geek. I'm not sure.
I don't see there's being an issue with that at all, Steve, if I'm being honest with you. I don't think there's any issue being a bit geeky, a bit nerdy about things. Two words I'm definitely reclaiming in a positive sense on this evening's show. We like to find things that are really of interest. You look at it and go, oh, that looks good. What's that? Like, I don't know, a book called Opulence and Ostentation. I'm interested. What's this about? Well, it's about the history of circus. circus as we know it. Steve Ward, the man who's been behind this whole project, put the book together, and he's now officially in the world via Modern Vaudeville Press, which is where you can go and get the book and all your usual outlets as well. What was the idea behind the name here, Steve? Was there a sort of a discovery you found that sort of led you to those two words?
The more I looked into the structures of the buildings around Europe in particular, they were very, very opulent in their decoration, and they were very ostentatious, and opulence and ostentation leapt out of me, and there you are. And I had to put Building the Circus as a subtitle, otherwise people wouldn't know what I was writing about.
Could have been wigs, could have been shoes, could have been anything at
absolutely
that point. We've talked about the modern circus quite a bit, and I know the book is very much sort of focused on that era, but I wondered, before that time, before the 18th century, how different was circus? Do you know how much it sort of changed into what we now know of as the circus?
Yeah, I mean, the watershed moment was 1768, when the retired cavalryman Philip Astley started giving demonstrations of equestrianism, horsemanship, military riding and trick riding. That's where it all started.
Yeah.
But before that time, going back into ancient civilizations like the Egyptians, the Minoans, the Romans, the Greeks, they all had recognizable circus-style entertainments. They didn't call it circus. But you go and see in Egypt, for example, you can find tomb paintings of people juggling and doing acrobatics. So these activities were around for a long time, many, many, many centuries. And of course, during the medieval period, you had your itinerant performers, your jesters, your wandering troubadours. But there was never anybody at that point, there was no vehicle where these people could come together to present a particular style of performance. And it was Astley, as I mentioned earlier, who began in 1768. And although his initial shows were all equestrian-based, when within the space of a year or so, he had moved to a better site in London and he began constructing his first amphitheatre, he realised, because he was a businessman as well as a sort of circus entrepreneur, he realized that people want to be entertained not only with horses. So he introduced a clown, an acrobat, a tightrope walker, and a strongman into his act. So here we begin to see the beginnings of a circus as we might recognize it today.
I love the fact that strongman sort of something that's faded away quite a bit as well. That's sort of no longer quite as impressive because we've got world's strongest man of its own show in that sense. And I wonder like how much, like certainly a lot of it seems like it's hung on for quite some time since the sort of mid 18th century. But what's one of the newest things that's been added to the modern circus as we know it?
I think the seer, you've seen the acrobatic wheel.
Yep.
People spread eagled within a double rim. That's a relatively new invention, and that's taken off big time. I think a lot of the fire axe, the pole, the fire poi, the fire baton, the swinging fire axe seem to have come to the fore. Whereas we've lost some of the more traditional things. You don't see, as you've mentioned, you don't see as many strongmen, although you do still see them. Fakir work, which is lying on a bed of nails, sword swallowing and things like that, that's not as popular as it was, but it's still around.
Circus
reinvents itself, new things come along, and how long will it be before we have a robo-cirque, where we have a completely robotic circus with no humans?
Ooh.
I mean, there are robots that can juggle, that can ride a unicycle, that can walk on a tightrope. There are some circuses now that do not use wild animals, but they have holograms instead. So in the ring, they have a holographic image of an elephant or a tiger. And so the human performers interact with a hologram.
Like a hologram.
I
like the idea of that because it's using technology against that traditional kind of route of where it all came from. I just don't know. When you said about someone, like a robot being able to juggle, I thought, yeah, that probably sounds about right. Technology's probably got to that point where it can do that now. But I'm just not sure if I would be impressed by a robot juggling or doing a tightrope. I'd be more impressed by a human doing it.
It is the human interaction, because
yeah.
We as the circus audience identify with the performer. So when that person is on the high wire and they step out, they take that first step. Yeah, you know, we all of us take that involuntary breath.
We'll breathe in, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Don't fall, please don't fall.
And if they slip, as they will invariably do, because it's all part of the act,
yeah.
If they slip, we all gasp in fear. And when they've completed their act or they've got to the other side of the wire, then we all let out that collective sigh of relief.
We'll sit back. Thank goodness for that, yeah.
Which I don't think, you're absolutely right, you wouldn't get if it was just a robot. Because it's a piece of machinery and you don't get that same interaction. So there has to be a human element always in the circus.
Yeah.
And for me, there always has to be the ring, because the ring binds everybody together, which is why some circuses that now perform in theatres, you get a very two-dimensional image, whereas the circus ring is a three-dimensional space.
You're in the middle, you're surrounded by it. Yeah,
yep. It's a three-dimensional space to be filled. And we're all bound by that ring and we can see each other and we bounce off each other as an audience.
Yeah.
And there's that electricity that runs.
Just in case there are any young people listening to this right now, any young children listening to this, and they're excited by the idea of doing unicycle or trapeze and things, what is a good way in to circus as a youngster, Steve?
Your best way as a youngster is to see if there's a local youth circus in your area, and there are a lot around the country, and any young person will not be a million miles away from a youth circus. Your local library should be able to help. If not, get in touch with the Arts Council, your local Arts Council. They should point you in the right direction and go along, and you don't have to commit yourself to being a circus performer in the future.
No,
just go along,
give it a go,
go along and try it. Or if the worst comes to the worst, get three pairs of your dad's socks. Please get clean ones, don't get dirty ones, because they stick to your hands.
Yeah, clean ones,
right? So make them into a ball, three balls, and start to juggle at home with these sort of soft balls and just experiment. But I would say go to a youth circus first. Ask your local school. If you're in a school, your teacher may know of somewhere. And there may even be somebody in your school who also juggles or does a unicycle. You can tap into that as well.
And worst case scenario, if we can't find anything at all, I'll start one. I don't know how we do it, but we'll try and just start one. We'll just wing it from here. Steve, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for reaching out to tell us about the book coming out. It is out now, Opulence and Ostentation by Steve Ward, Building the Circus. It's been lovely to catch up with you. We've got all the details here. If you're not sure where to find more about it, you can always give us a call and we can pass it on. But Steve, it's great having you on the show. Look after yourself and I'll see you soon.